for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Last week, the FDA made a stunning announcement. Four members of Congress and a former commissioner had unduly influenced a decision to approve a medical device the agency's scientists had found unsafe. That revelation is just the latest setback for the agency charged with ensuring America's food is safe and drugs work as promised. Joining me in the studio to talk about what's gone wrong at the FDA and how she hopes to fix it, the agency's commissioner, Dr. Margaret Peggy Hamburg. And throughout the hour, I'll invite your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Remember, you can also join us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, Dr. Hamburg. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure, Diane.
Thank you. Tell us what happened with Regen Biologics.
Well, it's a very important episode, but what's mainly important about it is what we can learn from it to improve our systems going forward. It was a case that happened before I got to the FDA. It was in 2008, before the change in administrations. And it was it involved the approval of a device for knee problems that gets implanted. And it raised a lot of controversy. There was a lot of public attention, media attention, and congressional inquiry into whether our systems had been interfered with in unusual ways. And we felt it was very important that we take a look at this so that we could ensure that our systems for the review of medical products were as science-based, science-driven as could possibly happen. We are a very unique agency as a science-based regulatory agency with a public health mission. And at the end of the day, our commitment is to make sure that medical products, drugs, and medical devices are safe and effective for their intended use. So we took a close look at this. Internal review was undertaken by our three career scientists or three career employees at the FDA, our top scientist, our top lawyer, and our top policy person. They interviewed a lot of people. They reviewed all of the documents and came out with a series of recommendations, all of which we are following up on and will be implementing.
I guess for the general public, it becomes rather frightening that, in fact, after internal FDA scientists had said this device was unsafe, the device known as Manaflex, manufactured by Regen Biologics, it was unsafe as a knee device because it did not work. And yet you had the commissioner himself, Dr. von Eschenbach, your predecessor, moving to approve it on pressure from four members of Congress. Senators Robert Menendez, Frank Lautenberg, Congressman Frank Malone, Steve Rothman, all of this reported in the New York Times. Surely that diminishes the kind of faith that the public can have in an agency like the FDA.
Well, the critical thing is that we need to rebuild the trust and confidence in the FDA. That is my highest priority. And part of that is ensuring that we have the sound systems for regulatory review and the best possible science being brought to bear on the review process. We have to have systems in place that have absolute integrity, that enable a robust discussion of the data, that all voices be heard, but at the end of the day, that the decisions made are science-based and science-driven. The concern with this particular instance was not so much that the congressman raised issues to the FDA. I do think that members of Congress have a right to bring the concerns and perspectives of their constituency forward, whether it's individuals or companies. But we cannot allow those inquiries to color our interpretation of the science. And that's what went wrong here. And that's what we need to correct going forward.
So how do you, as the newly approved commissioner of the FDA, ensure that that does not happen again? You will always, perhaps, face pressure from members of Congress. You will always face pressures from industry. And in this case, as the New York Times reported, a commissioner himself has never been accused before of caving into industry and congressional pressure.
Well, you know, I don't want to get into the details of the report, but I don't honestly know whether Commissioner von Eschenbach had a particular message when he got involved to say approve it or disapprove it. He clearly was more proactively engaged in trying to straighten out the process in terms of what he, quote-unquote, perceived as a chaotic situation. But what clearly happened was that decisions were made in unusual ways. There were additional people brought in, hand-selected by the commissioner's office, to help review the data. It did not follow our standard procedures. What I really want to underscore is that going forward, there are a couple things that we can do to strengthen our systems and ensure integrity, and that's what's really important. In the medical device arena, the fundamental regulatory pathway has a lot of ambiguity. It is not as well defined. It is not the modern regulatory pathway that we would like to see. And so we've asked the Institute of Medicine to actually bring together a group of experts to review what's needed for responsible and appropriate medical device review in the modern era. And that's going to be very valuable to the agency going forward. We also are trying to put in place new and better systems for resolving scientific disputes, because we have to recognize that we often have to make very hard decisions based on imperfect data. These decisions are not easy because we don't always have everything we need to know in order to really ensure safety and effectiveness. So it's very important. Good scientists, high integrity individuals can disagree on what's the appropriate action to take. So we need to make sure that we have systems in place to enable full discussion, to enable all perspectives to be heard and considered, so that at the end of the day, we can make the best possible decision for the American people.
Now, there was indeed one other person who resigned, and that was Daniel Schultz. His staff alleged that under his leadership, they were pressured to approve certain products. Now, you know, you've got a whole team there. You've got people of integrity, presumably, who have been involved in a revolving door situation. And that's been tough for the American people to believe in when they see individuals come in, either politically or scientifically, who've been involved with the industry, and then they're there to make policy. Why did Daniel Schultz resign?
Well, first, you know, let me underscore that we undertook this review in order to learn lessons moving forward. And, you know, I want to put the emphasis on the positive, which is that every day the FDA is involved in making decisions that affect every American in a million ways. And most of those decisions are really good decisions. It's extraordinary what the FDA does. We regulate 25 cents on every dollar that consumers spend on products. So, you know, whether it's the toothpaste you use in the morning or at night, or the food you eat, the drugs you take, the vaccines you may take for yourself or give your children, the face creams, you know, the cleansing lotions. FDA is an extraordinary agency with a cadre of remarkable scientists and other employees who are dedicated and committed and hardworking.
But why did Daniel Schultz resign?
Well, he and I had a discussion. There were a number of things about the leadership in that center that concerned me and others. I felt that we needed to start a new day. We needed new leadership, and we needed really to make sure that these kind of doubts were no longer in the air.
Dr. Margaret Peggy Hamburg, she's an expert in community health and biodefense. She is the new head of the Food and Drug Administration. Welcome back. Dr. Margaret Hamburg is the newest commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. She's here in the studio. She'll be answering your questions in just a moment. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Dr. Hamburg, what's the latest on the H1N1 or swine flu vaccine? When is it going to be widely available, and which groups are you targeting?
Well, the H1N1 vaccine has been licensed. It's being manufactured, and we expect the first lots to be available for administration to Americans in the next couple of weeks, early October. We are targeting certain higher risk groups for the initial vaccination, and that includes children and young adults. It includes pregnant women. It includes healthcare workers and also individuals taking care of infants 6 months and younger. And we're targeting those groups because, as we have watched the experience to date with this 2009 H1N1 virus, those groups seem to be particularly at risk. People with underlying medical conditions need to get vaccinated early because it's the people, the young adults and middle-aged individuals with underlying medical conditions that have also been particularly hard hit today.
Now, a number of people have expressed concerns about what the side effects might be of this drug, how safe it is, both short and long term. I'm sure you remember the Guillain-Barré syndrome that developed as a result of some of the earlier vaccines. What guarantees can be offered by this new H1N1 swine flu vaccine?
Well, this new H1N1 vaccine is being made exactly like the seasonal flu vaccine that we've been using for a very, very long time. We have experience now with hundreds of millions of doses of this vaccine being used by people, and we have a lot of confidence in safety. In addition, we are doing additional studies to ensure both safety and effectiveness, and we are putting in place an elaborate system for tracking possible adverse reactions. We do this every year. This year, we're adding some additional studies and systems so that we can really keep our finger on the pulse of what's going on in terms of the use of the vaccine and any possible complications that might occur.
Where does your confidence come from in the case of this particular vaccine?
Well, as I said, it's being manufactured just like the seasonal flu vaccine.
Where?
Oh, well, there are a number of different companies that are manufacturing
Where?
The vaccine. Where?
Yes.
These vaccines are all being manufactured in this country, except one manufacturer is in Canada.
One in Canada.
Uh-huh.
And are they all being tested? Have they been tested on human beings?
Well, they are being tested on human beings, and the initial findings are very, very encouraging in terms of safety, and also that we're getting a very strong immune response that is actually kicking in a little bit faster than we thought. So it means that the vaccine will be effective pretty soon after you get the vaccination, and that's important. And we also now have data to show that we only will need one dose for most people. We thought it might be two, and that would mean there'd be less vaccine to go around. So far, the news is all good.
Wasn't there some talk that teenagers might need as many as four doses?
You know, I don't think we were ever thinking four doses, but two doses was a possibility. But the initial data suggests not.
And then for older people like myself who've been taking the ordinary flu vaccine for years and years, there's some indication, is there not, that perhaps I don't even need the swine flu vaccine?
Well, as we've been watching this H1N1 virus strain move through populations, so we've been studying it, it's been striking that the elderly population seems less vulnerable to serious complications than certain younger population groups. And this might be because of past exposures to a similar virus strain, which has given the elderly population a bit of protection from this novel strain that we're seeing now.
Let's hope that's the case. I think it's important for each individual to check with a family physician on precisely whether they need that swine flu vaccine or not, no matter what age group we're talking about.
Absolutely.
I'd like to go back to an earlier question, and this relates, Dr. Hamburg, to this whole issue of the revolving door. How will you, as the newest commissioner of the FDA, and I might say the youngest, how will you deal with this question of those who come from industry into the doors, into the laboratories of the FDA?
Well, first, I'm not sure that I'm the youngest FDA commissioner, but I'm flattered that you think I am.
I think you're pretty young.
But But I think, you know, it's an important question. But to turn it sort of on its side, I think it's very important that there be different perspectives. I think that an understanding of industry can help the work of the FDA. We don't want a revolving door, obviously. What's really critical is that we have people with the right expertise, the scientific skills to be able to review new products, and that we have the systems in place to ensure integrity and transparency. I think one problem with the FDA is that it's been a bit of a black box. People don't really understand how we make decisions and why. And I think we need to try to open it up more. We need to be able to explain ourselves. We need to be able to really elaborate our criteria. And we are working very hard. We've undertaken a major transparency initiative, which began the first week that I actually took on this new job, to try to address some of those issues.
Can you do that for us briefly? Can you tell us how you see your mission, how you believe you can create the transparency necessary?
Well, I think that we need to address this openness question on a number of different levels. One is that we need to get information that, in fact, is available now out there in ways that are more accessible to the people that need them, improving our website, working with the media, working with community groups, professional groups, patient organizations, consumer groups, and industry, in order to get information out there, make it more available, accessible, understandable. We also need to be more explicit about how we make decisions and why, and the data underlying our decision making. There are some parts of what we do that need to be kept confidential. There's, you know, commercial confidential information, whether it's on the drug side in terms of a specific product or the medical device side, or on the food side, you know, certain trade secrets about production methodologies. But a lot of what we do can be made more open to the public. And I'm awaiting the recommendations of this transparency task force that we established that's been looking in a systematic way, getting a lot of public input and input from stakeholders about what kind of information they'd like to see and what kinds of strategies they would recommend. But I'm expecting we're going to have a very aggressive agenda in this area. And I would love to see more openness, because I have been so impressed since I got to the FDA at all the really great work that FDA does that doesn't get out there. People only hear about us when there's a crisis and when there's a problem. So I'd like to see us getting out there more aggressively across a number of domains. But we've heard from so many groups and organizations and individuals that they are desperate to get more and better information from the FDA.
I must say, for quite a long time, it's been a concern of mine that the FDA relies so heavily on the research done by the pharmaceutical companies themselves, which then turn that information over to the FDA for evaluation. Now, in addition, the pharmaceutical lobbyists are here in Washington doing their very best to ensure that their drugs are approved, because there are such huge money-making factors. And yet, at the same time, you've got these so-called orphan drugs that do not get the attention they need. Why is it that the government has had to turn over to the pharmaceutical companies themselves the testing of drugs, and the approval of drugs is left only finally to the FDA based on the research of the pharmaceuticals themselves?
Well, the process really involves a company coming to the FDA with a new product for review and approval. And that new product is the property, the intellectual property of that company, and they are the ones that do the research. It is done in a rigorous fashion, reviewed by the FDA, with a lot of input about how to make sure that the research is done in a way that's scientifically appropriate and, of course, has all of the standards that must be there to ensure an appropriate study. Where there's other data available by outside researchers, that is terrific to bring to bear, and we always do. But it is a product being developed by a given company, and so there isn't a lot of other research out there on this novel product that is being brought to the FDA for review to go to market. So it is sort of the way the system is
has worked at 27 before the hour. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I don't think I need to remind you of thalidomide and the fact that you did have an outside researcher saying again and again that this particular drug would cause enormous harm, and yet no one paid attention within the FDA.
I don't think that's actually accurate. I think FDA played a very important role in identifying and responding to the problems of thalidomide.
After the fact, would you say?
I don't believe that that's the case, but, you know, we can go back and look at the historical
I
record.
I lived through that one, and I must say, I thought it was pretty ghastly that the researcher in England had pointed out over and over again to the FDA that this was a harmful drug, and yet it was approved, and only after the fact, when these poor children were born exactly as the researcher in England had said, then the FDA took the drug off the market.
Well, thalidomide is certainly one of the strong reminders about the importance of having a strong FDA that is responsive to all of the available data and acts when action needs to be taken.
Exactly. Tell us about cigarettes and the fact that the FDA is now going to place a ban on flavored cigarettes. And there is some talk that the FDA will place a ban on menthol cigarettes.
Well, the first step, as we are taking on this new regulatory authority for tobacco and tobacco products, is the ban on flavored cigarettes. And the law was very explicit about that. It gets much more complicated in terms of what is a cigarette, number one, and also what is a characterizing flavor. And so we are going to take a systematic look more broadly than just these initial sort of fruit flavors that were banned actually earlier this week. And we're putting together a scientific advisory committee to help us with some of these important decisions. And as we get our tobacco center up and running, and as we begin to implement the various components of this important new law, we will be looking more broadly at the components of tobacco and tobacco products.
What kind of pushback do you anticipate?
Well, you know, we've actually already been sued twice. So I suspect there will be a continuing back and forth as we move into this new area of regulatory authority and action. But this is very, very important to the health of the American people. Tobacco is the leading cause of preventable death. There's all sorts of associated illness and disability for those who are smokers in addition to death, and of course for those who are exposed willingly or unwillingly to tobacco smoke.
Why do you suppose, given all of the negative material information that's out there about smoking and cigarettes, why do you suppose young people continue to begin smoking?
Well, I think there's a culture that makes tobacco smoking and other tobacco products intriguing to young people. Maybe it's viewed as a rite of passage into adulthood. Maybe it's because it looks sexy or tough or cool. But it is clear that young people are a targeted audience for tobacco products, and that if you start smoking young, you smoke for a lifetime with all of the attendant problems. So we need to address that and reduce youth smoking.
Dr. Margaret Hamburg, she is the new commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. Short break, and then your calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by this and other NPR member stations, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org, and by Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at FordFoundation.org. This is NPR.
A little-known story behind the Cold War, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, on the visionary Air Force officer who changed the course of the nuclear arms race, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And I am delighted to correct myself on thalidomide. We've had a number of emails. Patrick tells us he's at St. Joseph Mercy Hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He says the FDA never approved thalidomide. All the birth defects were in Europe. In fact, Dr. Francis Kelsey at the FDA stood up to the company and kept it off the U.S. market. Thousands of babies in Europe were affected. Thank you all for your corrections. Let's go now to Vandila, Ohio. Good morning, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
And welcome to your guest.
Thank you.
I have a comment first in, about cigarettes, and then I have a question. First, my comment is this. Common sense would let us know that tobacco and all of its related health complications that are caused by that delivery system of these unique products that they come out with, whether it be filtered, unfiltered, et cetera, cause, and as your guest pointed out, cause not only harm to the person who is consuming these products, but also people around them, secondhand smoke, and its effects on
sure.
the workers,
sure.
et cetera, et cetera. My serious question is, we've danced this dance for years with tobacco, and you see no redeeming social or beneficial, whether it be thought to be sexy or cool or whatever. They're not helping anybody. Why is it that we keep selling this product?
Well, you know, I'm with you. I'd rather we lived in a world without tobacco products. But that is a bigger societal decision. The law is very clear in terms of the FDA role in regulating tobacco, and we are going to move forcefully and aggressively to put that law into action. And we hope that by doing so, we will be able to really make a difference in reducing the harm of cigarettes, in encouraging adults and young adults to quit, and preventing new smokers, particularly young people, from starting to smoke in the first place.
Dr. David Kessler, one of the former FDA commissioners, said if you can get a person not to smoke before the age of 19, you've got them. If they start smoking young, they're hooked. So that really is a challenge, isn't it?
That is a challenge, and it's one of our key issues in implementing this new law and why we have already acted to ban these flavored cigarettes.
All right, let's take a call from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning. I don't know if your new commissioner is aware that during the Madoff hearings, the Greek gentleman who blew the whistle on what was going on identified the Securities Exchange Commission and the FDA as a captured agency. I have personally experienced watching this with a guy by the name of Pazder, who was instrumental in pushing back a prostate cancer treatment that uses a biological treatment. And now he tried to stack the deck of a committee, but even then the committee voted 13-4 that it was effective and 17-0 that it was harmless. Yet that drug was pushed back 2 years with 70,000 men dying without any help. Now that the FDA is now in charge of tobacco, I've decided I'm going to get my own company going, and I'll just hire Pazder to push it through the system since all the inside information is always being released. I'm going to call my new cigarette Pokemon cigarettes, and I'm going to have them chocolate flavored with crayons in the back.
Dr. Hamburg.
Well, you know, I hear the caller's message about concern that new drugs that might be beneficial to people who desperately need them aren't being made available. And it's a real concern. And I think that while FDA has a very sacred obligation to ensure safety of new medical products, we also have an equally important obligation to make sure that promising new discoveries actually translate into the medical products that people need, and that is certainly a priority for me moving forward.
What is your 2010 budget like?
Well, the 2010 budget that the president has proposed actually includes a historic increase for the Food and Drug Administration, so we're very encouraged by that. This is an agency that has been under-resourced and underappreciated for far too many years. It has meant that our programs are very stretched. It has meant that we have not been able to put the focus and priority in key areas of concern to the health of the American people. And so it is wonderful to see a renewed commitment to the important and unique work of the FDA. And I have to say that when I was meeting with members of Congress prior to my confirmation in this new role, each and every member of Congress that I spoke to said that they wanted to support the FDA.
And yet there seems to be kind of a contradiction in terms, making sure that the FDA can do its job, but year after year after year, not funding it sufficiently to do its job.
Well, I think that's right. I think that reflects a couple of things. Number one, that people poorly understand the FDA and what it does, and that what it does is unique. We sit in this very important role as a science-based regulatory agency with a public health mission. What we do almost across the board is not done by anybody else at the federal level, at the state and local level, in the private sector, in the not-for-profit sector, or in the academic community. And so if we are not able to do our job and hopefully do it well, nobody else is going to backstop behind us. So it is essential that the FDA be given the resources that we need to do the job. Mm-hmm. And it becomes even more essential in a world where the science and technology is evolving very, very rapidly, meaning that there's lots of exciting new opportunities to bring new medical products to market and also to bring new science to bear on how we undertake our regulatory responsibilities. And also, in a world of globalization, the challenges for the FDA are vastly expanded because we are responsible for assuring the safety of products that are coming from hundreds of countries around the world and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of manufacturers and producers and distributors around the world.
And I gather the FDA has now opened offices in China and India, for example.
Yes, and in some other countries as well. We are really trying to expand our global presence. We're also, as we try to adapt to this global challenge, trying to work in closer harmony with our sister regulatory agencies so that we can share information as well as responsibilities, and also to help in the developing world, help those countries build their regulatory capacity. And this will benefit individuals living in those countries, but it will also benefit us so that either food that's produced or drugs and medical devices produced in those countries will be much more likely to meet the kinds of standards we require.
To Stephen in Vineland, New Jersey. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you. I have a question, a quick question, and then a statement. And the question just came up recently now with what the commissioner had just said. If safety is truly a concern for you, Commissioner, and efficacy of medications, then is it not time for a sincere commitment to researching medical marijuana for patients with conditions like multiple sclerosis, glaucoma, chronic pain? I'm a physician. That's the question. Now, as a physician, I am Dr. Stephen Fenichel, one of those that was arrested in the Senate Finance Committee hearing of Senator Max Baucus. And I appreciate what you said about the constituents, be they corporate or individual, have the right to advocate their positions with our senators and congressmen. But ultimately, the FDA has to research the evidence and protect the American people.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right that we need to have the best possible research done on important issues for health. And I think, you know, it's not exclusively the domain of FDA to do the research, though. We need to rely on the enormous scientific expertise in the academic research community as well as in industry. We need to rely on the global research enterprise as well. And I think that it is, you know, absolutely key that research questions that have important bearing on the health and well-being of individuals get done, and that when appropriate products can be developed to be taken to the marketplace, that FDA undertake their review.
We've talked about tobacco. We've talked about drugs. We've talked about devices, but we haven't talked about food. Tell me how broad the FDA's mission is in regard to food and what kind of authority you have.
Well, the food part of the Food and Drug Administration is very, very important. And frankly, I think it has been underaddressed in recent times. We can contribute an enormous amount, both in terms of food safety and also with respect to nutrition. And both has huge consequences for the health of the American people. Food safety is both a domestic and an international issue. We are building a much stronger program now, and I've reorganized FDA in some key ways to strengthen it internally, and President Obama has made a huge commitment to food safety, including putting together a food safety working group that's run out of the White House to bring together all the federal agencies responsible for food safety together to develop a plan and a set of action steps, and that's going forward. He also has given us a historic budget increase in his proposed 2010 budget, as I mentioned, for food safety. So we are doing a lot of work in that area, and I hope we'll be doing more in the nutrition area as well, because nutrition underlies so many serious health problems in this country: obesity, diabetes, hypertension, and stroke. We can do a better job, and we owe it to the American people.
And we've had an email asking about the increasing use of plastic bottled water, saying drainage of local aquifers where bottled water is produced, the decreasing use of water fountains, subsequent increased reliance on bottled water. Do you envision the standards for bottled water being tightened? The caller goes on to say, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that drinking water standards for bottled water are lower than those for municipal water.
The standards in the regulatory process are a bit different, but I think that both supplies are regulated, and you know, we have not had serious concerns with bottled water. But it's a very important issue. There are a lot of issues about bottled water that are now coming to the fore in terms of just the environmental impact of all those plastic bottles. That's beyond the scope of the FDA, but it's an important set of questions nonetheless.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And another caller asks about orphan drugs for people whose income is below poverty level. Some have to be compounded, a kind of fee system. Perhaps a new health plan might help.
Well, I think there are two separate issues there. Orphan drugs is a very specific category of drugs that are developed for diseases that only have a limited number of patients, 200,000 cases or less. And there's been a very important program with incentives to make more orphan drugs available. And we have seen a huge expansion in the number of orphan drugs being developed and approved since Congress enacted the Orphan Drug Act. I think it was back in 1983. That's been a real success story, and one that I think we can learn for in other areas. You know, with respect to making drugs more available for people without resources, that's why we need healthcare reform.
And one final question for you. FDA's primary tool of enforcement are warning letters sent to companies that violate rules for manufacturing or marketing products. And apparently over the last 10 years, the number of those letters has gone down the hill. Last year, for example, the agency issued 22 letters to drug companies for improper advertisements, down from 157 letters in 1998. First, how effective are those letters? And second, why the extreme drop in number?
Well, FDA has a number of tools for fulfilling its enforcement responsibilities. Warning letters is one. Other tools as well, in terms of asking companies not to put products out from manufacturer if we find serious defects, and also recalls. But I think that we have not been as aggressive in terms of our enforcement at the Food and Drug Administration. I've made it very clear since I have been in this new role that we ultimately have to respond to the health of the public, and that when there is reason to believe that there might be compromise, either in terms of a food product or a drug product or a medical device, we have to act swiftly and surely and use all of the authorities that we have to ultimately protect the health of the public.
Dr. Margaret Hamburg, she is the new commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. I want to wish you all success in your new position.
Thank you very much.
The health of the public is counting on you. Thanks. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.